Hey, this is Jesse. We're in Michigan City, about to have some breakfast. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Jesse, for that introduction. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is great to be here with you today here on show number 868. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN radio studio today. So good morning to Fergie. And we have an action-packed show for you today. We're talking about nuclear power. I didn't know this, but there is a lot of nuclear waste in the state of Illinois. Who knew? Well, some people knew, and it's a big problem. And we'll talk about the future of nuclear power here in the state. Also, AI, artificial intelligence, oh boy, the likes of ChatGPT and others, it's pretty serious stuff. It's incredible. Technology's great, but the impact of this, specifically on media, we will talk to the publisher of a local media outlet who is being impacted by AI, and the Blues Fest is next week, the Chicago Blues Festival, and so we will talk about Chicago Blues and the history of Chicago Blues. Stay tuned for all that. I'm told that we have to get right to it. There's no time for, you know, telling stories or anything like that. We got to get to the content, as they say, so we're going to. Here we go. In 1987, Illinois instituted a nuclear construction moratorium that prohibited the construction of new nuclear power plants until the federal government provided a permanent disposal solution for the high-level radioactive wastes produced by these power plants. A couple of weeks ago, the state voted to repeal this moratorium, and now it goes to Governor Pritzker's desk. So, what does this mean for Illinois? Well, David Kraft is the director of the Nuclear Energy Information Service. They are online at neis.org. That is a nuclear watchdog and safe energy organization based in Chicago. And David is here with us today on Outside the Loop. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for the invite, Mike.
You are quite welcome. So, okay, a little bit of history here. So, the purpose of the nuclear construction moratorium, again, this is 1987 when this is put into place. This was really about the concern regarding nuclear waste. That's really where all this starts, because we didn't and we still don't have a good place to put this stuff. So give us a little bit of background and context here.
Sure. In 1987, we were on the brink, Illinois was on the brink of having 14 operating nuclear reactors. At that time, and even at this time, that would have made us the 11th largest nuclear power in the world. Not in the country, in the world.
Wow.
And we are still are the largest nuclear dependent state in the United States. We're number one. We have 11 operating reactors. To date, we have 11,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste with no place to go. So it's not just that we don't have a good place to put it. We have no place to dispose of it. And I'm going to make a semantic distinction between disposing of the waste and storing the waste. And I make that because it's in federal law. So in 1987, as you pointed out, the issue was finding a place to dispose of the waste. And the federal government was supposed to do that. They failed to do it by 1997, which leaves every state that has a nuclear reactor essentially becoming a de facto storage site for radioactive waste. The feds say they're not going to have anything in operation at the earliest until 2048. So we are still a storage facility with no place to go. And that was actually the intention of the moratorium, was to prevent or at least minimize the creation of high-level radioactive waste, so that Illinois, back then the thinking was they were afraid we would become the nation's disposal facility, because it would make sense to move the least amount of waste, the shortest amount of distance. And here we are, equidistant from the coasts. We have the most waste here. Why not move everybody else's to Illinois? That was part of the thinking back in 87. Didn't work out that way, but it was a safeguard. And again, the idea was to minimize the amount of waste here in Illinois, currently sitting at every nuclear reactor in the state. So that was the thinking at the time.
Yeah, so here we are, 11 operational nuclear reactors in our state. We, as you say, we've created over 11,000 tons of spent reactor fuel. So we are the storage area, in a sense here. This is, I think, something that a lot of us might not know. We might think that, oh, isn't there a storage site in Nevada somewhere? I thought this was out west, but here we are close to lots of this material. And this material, as maybe we've heard, stays dangerous for thousands of years. So this is really about what has already happened and continues to happen, because the storage is here. We're not sending this elsewhere.
Correct. The issue we take with how this went down over the last 2 years, the legislature conducted about 5 or 6 different hearings, both on the House side, the Senate side, then on the floor debates. And we saw two things happening. The first was the legislature totally ignored the radioactive waste issue. You know, you're getting a taste of it right now for the first time, and it seems to surprise you. Well, these folks should know better. And we pointed it out to them 5 times that we have the most waste. We're going to get more because it used to be Exelon's reactors. Now it's Constellation Generation reactors are going to produce about 200 to 300 tons more per year as long as they operate with no place to go. And yet the legislature barely touched the issue in any of those debates that I mentioned. What they did talk about, though, was that they want to promote a new generation of reactors called small modular nuclear reactors, SMNRs.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, David, because you say that this repeal is a Trojan horse for these small modular nuclear reactors. Again, as you say, SMNRs, that's the abbreviation here. So can you tell us what are these SMNRs and how is this a Trojan horse?
Yes. So as I was mentioning in all these hearings, that was really the crux of the discussion, the crux of the debate. When the pro-nuclear team brought in expert witnesses, they didn't talk about waste. They talk about more reactors. So what does more reactors mean, and what are these SMNRs? First of all, they are non-existent. They are theoretical concepts. They are the fevered imagination of entrepreneurs and engineers and you know, folks who like to design things. They don't exist in real life. They won't exist even as a demonstrator until 2029. Yet our legislators were talking about these things as if you could go to the Family Dollar store and pick up a couple and put them online. You know, it was very surreal listening to these people discuss small modulars and promoting them up and down the line. Now, SMNRs, if they even work at all, and we don't even know that, wouldn't be available commercially until at least 2035. Yet the legislators are talking about it as a job opportunity, as improving system reliability, as fighting climate change. Well, we kept pointing out to them, it's like, well, wait a minute, guys, this isn't going to happen, even if it does happen, until 2035. So where is the benefit to pushing this thing now? And we never got any answers. They just kind of railroaded it through. This is a great opportunity. This is kind of like how adolescents buy their first car. You know, if it's red, it's fast, it's a convertible, buy it. What about the cost? What about insurance or the mileage or operating and maintenance? Who pays for it? No discussion. So we feel that this was kind of a railroad job, and that's where the Trojan horse piece comes in. They use the repeal of the moratorium as the way to open the barn door to anything to come in that's nuclear. And they started out by talking about small modulars. Now, at the very last minute, the 11th hour, like this was the week before the session was supposed to end at May 19th, in the House, downstate Representative Yednock introduced an amendment which totally changed the discussion. He introduced an amendment that talks about advanced reactors. Well, again, the ignorance of the legislators really shows here. They don't know the difference between the two, and they are different things. small modulars are advanced reactors, but not all advanced reactors are small modular reactors. And we couldn't get them to understand the distinction between the two. Small modulars, there is no technical definition at federal law, but it's well understood that they would be a reactor, anything from a small test reactor like is being proposed at University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, all the way up to about 300 megawatts, which would be a very small gas plant or coal plant sized reactor. That, when you talk about small modulars, that's what you're discussing. When you talk about advanced reactors, you go into whole different designs that weren't even debated, and you go up to as large as the reactors that we have going today, which could be up to 1,000 or 1,100 megawatts. They would require a totally different kind of security. They would require the kind of containment like what we have at our reactors today. There was no opportunity to discuss that or debate that. So at the very last minute, this amendment got passed, which means all of the debate that took place over the last 2 years and five hearings became irrelevant. And that's how this legislation got snuck through at the last minute. So we're talking about a bait and switch, a Trojan horse, which has opened up Illinois to become, again, a vast creator of radioactive waste over time with no place to dispose of.
You know, I'm thinking about how we recently, the last year or two, we passed the Clean Energy Jobs Act in Illinois. And recently, on this very show, I talked with State Senator Robert Peters about the push for wind power and renewable energy in this state. And what you're talking about here, it seems that this issue is kind of running counter to that. So here we are making these forward steps, and then we're talking about, well, nuclear energy, which is going to produce this waste that we have no place to put. That just seems like this is running counter. And I think it's in that way, it's very disjointed. It's kind of confusing and it doesn't quite make sense. It's like the left hand is doing one thing and the right hand's doing another.
You're absolutely right. And that was another point we made to the legislators was, look, you guys worked really hard for 2 years to get CEJA passed. And the intent was to build renewable energy, energy efficiency, energy storage, and improved transmission system. Now you want to add hypothetical small nuclear reactors into the mix. What that does is instead of supplementing or being a complement to CEJA, it becomes a competitor to the goals of CEJA, because small modulars will compete for market share, which is going to drive down prices if they do get built. And also it competes with being able to get on the transmission grid, which is a real serious problem nationwide right now. If we don't have a better transmission system, you could have a million small reactors or you could have a million wind turbines. And if they're not able to be connected to your customer, they're worthless. So we pointed this out to the legislators and say, look, you are undermining the goals of CEJA. You are making a new competitor, which is nuclear, which creates waste and hazard that we don't need if you would just build more renewables and focus on those goals instead. And again, we got no response to that. We even pointed out that the very day that this passed the Illinois Senate, an 800 megawatt solar installation broke ground in Sangamon County, right under their noses in Springfield. And this facility is going to be ready next year. So you get an equivalent of a small coal plant or even a large coal plant, 800 megawatts, that can be built in 2 years. It can provide power, which they are concerned about downstate. They won't have enough power. And it addresses the system reliability concerns that they had, because as you add more renewables, it evens out some of the reliability issues that they were concerned about. This is real world stuff. And they turned and just ignored it completely, and instead voted in favor of this pipe dream.
So, David, why do you think this is happening? Is this a case of the nuclear industry is lobbying the legislature and they have a powerful lobby here? Because what you're saying is frustrating, I think, for a lot of us who are kind of shaking our heads saying, man, I can't believe this is happening, and wondering, like, what are these people looking at in terms of data here? So why do we think this is happening?
After the last hearing, I went out in the halls of the hearing, was shaking my head, and I overheard somebody use the word grease. because the vote was so absolutely absurdly lopsided. I mean, there was no rational discussion going on at all. What we're afraid of is that this is the ghost of Michael Madigan past. You know, there was this whole Paola energy system going on for 40 years, and we think we're still seeing some of the residue from that. In fact, there was another terrible bill that was put forward that deals with downstate Illinois, which is called the right of first refusal. And that's another energy dog. The two taken together are out there to entrench current energy monopoly, both upstate and downstate, on the part of the usual cast of characters. ComEd up north, Ameren down south. As I mentioned, Constellation Generation, which runs the reactors. It's the same good old boy network for energy. And they do see renewables as a serious competitor, and they're going to do all they can to thwart it. The only difference this time is they're trying to put some distance between themselves and the ComEd corruption issue and the Madigan corruption issue. So they're letting the IBEW kind of push this along, make that a champion of the bill. So labor, a select portion of labor, not all labor, is also an ally pushing this kind of legislation. So again, it's the ghost of Madigan passed on the one hand. And if you look at nationwide, the level of corruption with the nuclear industry is astronomical. We not only had the FBI scandal here in Illinois with Michael Madigan and the ComEd executives, you had a corruption scandal in Ohio, which again brought indictments against the Speaker of the House there and several other House members. You had a South Carolina utility executive be indicted and convicted on a $9 billion reactor fraud. So these folks are well connected. It's big money, and they see renewables as the competitor. But yet nobody talks about the corruption angle. And we have to wonder why. We'll leave that to a great investigative reporter to ferret that one out.
Well, follow the money. That's what we should do. That's what we have to do when it comes to politics here in Illinois. And we can all go to your website, NEIS.org. That's the website for the Nuclear Energy Information Service. That is a nuclear watchdog and safe energy organization based in Chicago. And David Kraft is the director of that organization, talking to us about the possibility of the repealing of this nuclear construction moratorium. We'll see where this goes, but the information is out there. And David, thank you for talking to us today and giving us an education about what's happening here, and keep doing what you're doing.
We appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Michael.
Chicago neighborhood of McKinley Park is situated about 4.5 miles southwest of the Loop, and since 2016, the McKinley Park News has served this neighborhood with free news coverage and reporting, along with calendars, listings, and interactive features. Their website is mckinleypark.news. The publisher of the McKinley Park News is Justin Kerr, and he's also the CEO of Local News LLC. He recently publicly issued a warning that he will stop the publication of the McKinley Park News if the current state of AI isn't remedied. AI, if you haven't heard, stands for artificial intelligence. And we've seen programs like ChatGPT answer questions, write reports, research papers, and even create news stories. Justin Kerr is with us here today. Justin, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. And you recently wrote a letter from the editor about this issue of AI on your site. So specifically, Justin, tell us at the outset here, what is your complaint about the current state of AI and what you do?
Well, let's first specify that what I'm specifically referring to is something called large language models, which is the technology that's used to power all of the contemporary AI interfaces, like this human-seeming chat interface. My main complaint about how all of this is being launched and developed is that, you know, I have a unique and valuable information product as a business that I publish on the McKinleyPark.news website. I have specific terms of service that specify the conditions that I offer this information. And that's, you know, pretty much focused on being used, our news and information and events is for individual people to consume, you know, and not for any other purpose. And in our terms of service, I explicitly prohibit any other use and explicitly prohibit things like our content being slurped up by AI or large language models or other services and then used to create for-product profits and services, you know, based on that, or used for other people's profits without authorization from us. I discovered maybe 2 weeks ago by happenstance that it looked like all of our content was being sucked up and integrated into these large language models, or at least, you know, some of the most popular ones. And then those large language models are being used not only to create products and services that directly compete against us based on our own product and service and, you know, my labor, they're also selling that ability to all of these third parties, to anyone else who wants to use our stolen content to launch services that compete directly against me. Huh. And so that's pretty much the primary concern and focus. These folks are stealing everything that I do. And the letter to the editor talks about, you know, how this affects us for past, current, and future revenue opportunities, how it means that basically it kills local news. No one is ever going to be click over to a local news website anymore because they're just going to get the answer from the AI. And despite this, all of the AI's capacity to answer their questions or to provide any sort of good answer is going to be based on the content that they've taken from us. I'm using the McKinley Park News as an example, but it affects so many others.
Yeah, right. That's the thing. It's like, this is, and by the way, what a futuristic conversation we're having here. The machine's taking over. Yeah. It's amazing. So you run a very hyper-local site, and instead of, you know, people going to the McKinley Park News site, they could just go to the AI bot, whatever it is, ask a question about McKinley Park, and that AI, because it has gobbled up your content, will yep. use your content to answer that question. So why then even go to your content in the first place?
Exactly. And of course, you know, this is a system that destroys itself, that cannibalizes itself. You know, I lose all motivation to do any work as a local news publisher because, you know, everything's going to be stolen from me and I'll never be able to compete with these products and services, you know, that use my labor to compete against myself.
It's scary because it could put you out of a job. Like, who needs an editor yes. anymore, right?
Exactly.
That's the scary thing is if you think about journalism and, okay, we have editors and we have fact checkers. Well, hey, in theory, couldn't we just use AI?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And that will be their ability to conduct that labor will be based on the theft of expertise stolen from everyone else without their consent or any sort of remuneration. There's also the nature of this. This is a perpetual theft. You know, it looks like they have stolen the entirety of my website, all of my content, all of my features and everything that I do, and they put it into these large language models that are just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. So these companies, these for-profit companies, could be making money off of my labor for decades without paying me a cent, you know, the way things currently are running.
Can you tell, I mean, when you look at a website sort of behind the scenes, and you have many articles up on your McKinleyPark.news site, can you tell that this article or this portion of my site has been kind of sucked up into this large language model AI thing, or is it pretty much just like it gets it all at once?
So one of the problems is that the discovery process of finding out if your content has been stolen or not is fraught with danger. I'm still trying to find a lawyer to give me a good answer about how we can discover whether or not our content's been stolen or not without running afoul of the AI's own terms of service. And, you know, if you engage with an AI, you kind of poison yourself because you have to necessarily agree to their terms of service, which may limit your rights for remuneration moving forward. And anything, any action, any interaction that you engage with the AI feeds the AI, and it can take action or learn from you and what you're doing. And so I purposely have not engaged with any AI interfaces in order to not pollute myself or limit my options. Instead, I've used one third-party service that kind of gave me the general information that, yeah, it looks like all of your stuff is being stolen by the most popular large language models out there. And then other people, other third parties, you know, that I've been corresponding with have said, yeah, it looks like that's the case. So there's also big problems to even tell if your product has been stolen or content's been stolen, if it's being used, how it's being used, how much it's being used, et cetera. You know, so that even that process is difficult.
So this is your business, and obviously you need to make money and you want to put out good content. And I think for many of us, this just isn't top of mind yet. I mean, I'm in the education field full time. So obviously I'm thinking about this because, hey, let's not cheat. Let's write your own papers. But that information's coming from somewhere. So I think I know the answer to this question, but I just have to ask the question. I'm assuming there are no laws that deal with this. Is that right?
Well, so there are no specific laws that deal with this, but to me, this seems like a straightforward, I guess if you call it a legal tort. You know, I have a for-profit business that's done tons of labor and work to make my own product offered under specific terms, and another or several other entities or who knows how many people and entities have taken all of my labor and my work in violation of my terms of service, and they've stolen it, and they're using my stuff to make money for themselves. I mean, how is this not just straight up theft? How is this not just, it's so obvious that this is wrong. Despite that, there are no established regulations or laws for how this is being used. And another problem I've discovered too, is that a lot of the law firms and institutions and journalism institutions, et cetera, not only are they, you know, kind of gun shy about jumping into this, they also have been poisoned by the AI because they are adopting AI technologies and uses within their own organizations without considering any of these ethical concerns. And then the other thing too is I think that the people who are in charge of this understand exactly what they're doing. The AI leaders, et cetera, you know, there's a gold rush going on. And these guys' philosophy, as I said in the letter from the editor, is to move fast and break things. They don't care who gets harmed by their theft. They are jumping in as rapidly as they can, making as much money as they can that publishers like the McKinley Park News will never see a cent of. And then, you know, then they're going to let the chips fall where they may. Well, we may have a, you know, smoking crater of, you know, dead news ecosystems everywhere because they've, you know, hollowed everything up.
And this is coming for everyone. I mean, we want to emphasize this. We don't feel it maybe, but this is going to be very widespread, probably in the not too distant future.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the theft is going on right now. These companies are raising billions of dollars based on products and services that they're launching, you know, that they use stolen property to build, including from the McKinley Park News. I can't see how any of this is proper. I can't see how any investor in AI would not be worried about how their investment might get tied up in all sorts of court cases and big litigation problems because of the theft is so blatant. I mean, these companies are thieves. I call it large larceny models instead of large language models, you know, in terms of the way that some of these folks are implementing them. It's beyond the pale.
So you're working with lawyers, you're trying to find some legal remedy to this. And is that really all you can do at this point? I feel like, you know, I like to end a conversation maybe on a high note and say, hey, what's being done and what are you doing besides exploring the avenues that you've already told us?
My letter from the editor contains a number of remedies that I ask for from a number of different entities and types of entities related to the AI issue. In terms of businesses and large language model developers and operators that are out there, you know, they need to ensure that our stuff is not in their large language model. They don't have a license to use it. They need to remove any of that stuff. If they've already been making money off of my content, then they need to have their comptroller get in touch with me so I can give them an invoice and a bill, you know, because they've been making a bunch of money off of my labor that I'm not seeing any money, any compensation for the purposes of journalism institutions. You know, a lot of these journalism institutions and Industry leaders are jumping right into AI without considering any element of the ethics of it. And I would ask that journalism institutions, universities, schools, associations, and folks like that don't, you know, adopt policies to ensure they're not training people to steal from us, that they're not, you know, training people on products that are built on stolen goods and labor. So there's some other things that I say, you know, I they should pay us, they should pay journalists and publications for what they've already stolen. They should allow us to organize and license our content to be used by AI. This is a potential revenue stream for McKinley Park News and other publications that's being stolen from us. You know, we should be able to go to say, hey, AI, if you would like the most, if you want your AI to be the smartest AI for McKinley Park, come to the McKinley Park News. We'll license our content into your large language model. You can do it for the next year, and we get some revenue. They get a bunch of benefit. I mean, that's all being cut out by this theft. There's so many elements of revenue that's just being stolen in addition to just the straight up content and expertise that's being stolen.
Well, I think what we should do is go to your website, McKinleyPark.news. Let's give you some love. Let's give you some clicks, and let's give your organization some attention, because this is something that is really coming for everyone. I mean, big organizations, big journalism outlets, small shops kind of like yours. And this is something that we really have to pay attention to. And I don't know where all this is heading, but there are some pretty dark scenarios that we've discussed, and we just need to regulate it right now, I think, and let's get ahead of this thing. And so everyone should go to McKinleyPark.news and check out the McKinley Park News. Justin Kerr is the publisher of that outlet. He's also the CEO of the Local News LLC. Hey, Justin, thank you for talking to us today. I'm sorry this is happening. We're going to see more of this, and really good luck going forward.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, one good thing is there are a whole lot of publishers, including from the Chicago Independent Media Alliance, who are concerned about this. And we're trying to get a group together. We're organizing. We're not going to let this stand.
Music. I love it. And this genre of music has a rich history in Chicago. Next weekend is the annual Chicago Blues Festival downtown. And because that's happening next weekend, we should also talk about the documentary film called Born in Chicago. It's coming to streaming platforms on August 1st. There's a sold-out screening that's happening next Friday at the Chicago Cultural Center. And this film takes us on a journey of blues history and what it was like learning this art from the blues masters themselves. John Anderson is the co-director of this movie, Born in Chicago. He is also an Emmy-winning and Grammy-nominated director, producer, and editor. And he is here with us today on Outside the Loop. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. So this film is, I think this is so cool, the story that you're telling here, because you do get into some history when it comes to blues. And of course, in Chicago, I mean, synonymous with the blues. But at the outset here, this was a project that you did. It was released about 10 years ago now. So tell us, if you would, what did you set out to do with this film? And why did you want to tell the story of the blues in this particular way?
Well, as a music lover and a longtime Chicagoan, I knew the outlines of the story. I knew about the tough white teenage kids, musicians. I'm talking about Michael Bloomfield, Paul Butterfield, Charlie Musselwhite, Barry Goldberg, Elvin Bishop, Harvey Mandel. I'm sure I'm leaving some out. Steve Miller, Corky Siegel,
sure.
Who took to the South and West sides to immerse themselves in the music that they loved. And it was a place that kids like them hadn't really gone before. And the musicians, they saw them, and they saw that they could play, and they loved them, and they nurtured them. I'm talking about Wolf and Muddy, and they treated them like sons. And a deep bond was established between them. These guys then, not only, you know, did they have the guts to go down to these clubs, they could really play. So it was a confluence of some wonderful and amazing things.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, they took the blues, the electrified Chicago blues, to rock and roll. So I kind of knew the story. I was shooting a concert that Chicago Blues Reunion was doing at Park West in 2008, and that band is comprised of four of the principals of the story: Nick Ravenitis, Harvey Mandel, Corky Siegel, and Barry Goldberg, with Marcy Levy on vocals. And as we were doing the interviews, as I was doing them with Tim Martin, the executive producer, it just, the thing just came to life, you know? I mean, I knew I'd been making music documentaries for years, and this was just a story that had to be told. So we did a rough cut. We showed it at the Film Row Cinema, which is part of Columbia College down on Wabash, in June of 2010. Sold out house. People loved it. Barry Goldberg, the producer, the co-producer, sent it to his buddy Elliot Roberts, who manages Neil Young. Neil loved it. Neil played it for Bob Dylan. He loved it. I'm not kidding you here. This stuff is true, okay? This film has a story arc, all right? And we're in the happy part now, okay? This is the happy part. So that was all we needed to kind of get the thing really shot. So Barry and I were compadres, and we traveled this country and collected the interviews with all of the people I mentioned there, basically, along with Eric Burden of the Animals and Marshall Chess and Jack White and B.B. King and Hubert Sumlin and a bunch of people, and made a first cut in about 2012, 2013. It was called White, Black, and Blues then, and actually the title had changed by the time it got a great review in Rolling Stone and in the New York Times and a couple of sold out screenings of South by Southwest. I thought we were on our way. Okay. It really seemed like success was imminent. I had to move on to work on the Sam Lay film, Sam Lay and Bluesland. And then that led into the Paul Butterfield film, Horn from the Heart. I kind of lost touch with the film, and here's where the sad part starts. Okay. The film, let's say it languished. Okay. It wasn't sold. Come 2018, Bob Sarles, my co-director on the film, and his wife and filmmaking partner, Christina Keating, along with the writer Joel Selvin, they took on the project, and they brought it across the finish line. They gave it their own thing, and that's what we're going to see this week at the Chicago Cultural Center.
Yeah, and again, August 1st, coming out on streaming platforms. We'll mention that again, but this story of the blues in Chicago, and from this perspective of these young white musicians who were great players, and how they were these kids essentially, and they had the wherewithal to go to these clubs and sit in with these blues masters. And that's not something that you really hear about anymore. The fact that you could go to these musicians who were playing all the time in Chicago and sit down with them, and they would teach you the craft. I mean, talk about an education. That is a priceless education, learning from these guys. But that was something that was happening, on more than one occasion, for sure, fairly often with these musicians that you profile. And it just doesn't happen like that anymore, I feel like.
No, it doesn't. And let me interrupt by saying that, back to the story arc, now we're back on the happy part again, okay, with all of the success that the film has had recently. You're right. These are unique kids, you know. They weren't, I don't want to generalize, but they were outcasts. You know, Barry met Michael Bloomfield at each of their respective third high schools. they marched kind of to their own beat, and the Wolf and Muddy saw this, and as did all of the rest of the musicians. And it was relit when we walked into the interview with Hubert Sumlin some 50 years after the fact, Barry and I, and they just rekindled their memories and compared stories and hugged each other for about 6 minutes. And there was not a dry eye in the house. And to see, to see that sort of a scene come to life is just, so rewarding to me. And I know that that's the spirit that drives Bob also.
It's fascinating, I think, to sort of trace the roots of the music. And, when we talk about blues, the African-American experience in the South, and then the Great Migration to the North and here in Chicago, and how these musicians that go on to craft what we know in the mainstream as rock and roll. I mean, this was the formation of that. And this film, this story, talks about that. You know, you can't have the Rolling Stones or Dylan or any of these people without people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Buddy Guy. It's really so connected.
That's right. And you can't show it in a film without collecting the footage to show those guys. And that became one of the biggest challenges for all of us involved in the film. You know, archival footage, the expense of it, and the music expenses are what so often keep these films from getting made. But luckily, I was able to call in some favors, as was Bob. And my biggest one, of course, was Sam Lay, who bought, you know, for his wife, I have my finger quotes up now, in 1964, an 8 millimeter camera, silent camera. I don't know that she ever laid hands on it, but he then took it to all of the clubs around the country and the world that he played for about the next 15 or 20 years, collecting this beautiful color footage that some of it is for sale via one of the archival houses, and some of it was kept under his bed. All right? I kid you not. All right? So I brought him over to my house, and we set up a film wind, and we looked at it and set up a microphone, and he described to us what it was. And if we hadn't been able to use that stuff, seriously, I don't think the film could have gotten made.
Chicago as an influence here. So we know the place, right? Chicago, this is a blues. This has always been, you know, for especially in the 20th century, a blues town. But the influence of Chicago in general, the people here, that's something that we can't understate, really. I mean, this is something that Chicago is a special place where all of this is happening. You've got these young kids who are learning the craft. You've got these masters who come here. You have the electrification of blues. I mean, Chicago is a very special part of this story.
It is, and specifically Hyde Park is, you know, along with, of course, the West and the South Side clubs. But Hyde Park, as you know, was where it really all started. It's where Alvin met Paul. It's where Nick Gravanitis, like Alvin, was a student at the University of Chicago. These were kids, you know, Alvin had a National Merit Scholarship. These were smart kids who were looking for a different kind of life. You know, to Nick, he wanted to be a beatnik, you know, and to get to meet these guys and to hear their stories, it's been amazing. And, you know, yes, Chicago is it, and I give a lot of the credit to Hyde Park. And, you know, Butterfield, he and Nick were kind of the leaders, along with Bloomfield. But part of the reason that Butterfield was so well accepted in the genre, in the milieu, was that his father was known to people. He was a lawyer who was on the right side of civic issues, civic and racial issues. So he already had a little bit of cred just walking around. Besides the fact that, of course, you know, Nick didn't feel comfortable around black people. At first, he grew up in an all-Greek neighborhood, but Paul did. So when you have kind of that spark, it really helps to make the flower grow, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I mean, today we think about issues with race that we're going through, and you look at the story here, and sure, different backgrounds, certainly people were treated differently, and to be honest, sometimes still are because of how they look. This was the uniting force that they had, and they came together, and they really, you know, this is a cliche, but they fell in love with each other and the music, didn't they?
They did. And that's what is at the heart of this film, and is at the heart of the question that sometimes comes up of cultural appropriation. And I wish Bob were with us today, because he has put it very eloquently in the past. But cultural appropriation suggests that the white guys took something. Not only that they took something, but that they didn't pay it back. They took it for their own gain. First of all, it was a present. It was a shared love of these 12 bars of blues that, you know, these black people and white people who happen to have different colored skin felt for each other. Secondly, as is made clear in the film, these white guys, as soon as they started having a little sway, they started telling the world about B.B. King, about Little Walter, about Muddy Waters. And it's, you know, the Bill Graham had all the influence on the West Coast, so Butterfield and Bloomfield went to him and said, hey, you need to book these guys in your venues. And as you know, Chicago made its own mark and its own statement in many ways, but the biggest one was the one that was known as Fathers and Sons, which was a concert that was held at the Auditorium Theater in August of 69, featuring Muddy, featuring Gravanitis, and a bunch of the white and black blues guys. It was a sold-out smash that, as Marshall Chess said, looked like the collection of all of the people who had been jammed into all the blues clubs for the last 20 years, just kind of coming out into the open. And to this day, it's Muddy Waters' biggest record.
Wow, that is amazing. Well, this film, Born in Chicago, is the name of the film. Born in Chicago, thefilm.com is the website. And tell us about what's happening August 1st here. So if we want to see this film coming up later this summer, it sounds like on streaming platforms, this is going to happen. Tell us the details.
Details are Shout Factory. Look them up. A great distributor founded by Richard Foos, who I believe co-founded Rhino Records, and a very cool guy. He and his company are putting it out to all of the streaming services. We'll have more details on it soon, but I believe it's August 1st. And, you know, we may have another screening in the area, as I say, before then to help hype it and to take advantage of some of the momentum we have here from the Blues Festival.
So this project, Born in Chicago, ups and downs for sure, but this was something that was and is important to you. As you think back about this, because you started this more than 10 years ago, is there something that sticks out to you about this whole thing today? Something that really leaves a mark on you from going through this experience as you reflect back?
Well, this is the third, I guess you could say, of a Chicago blues trilogy that I've worked on. That's the one that I started first, and then came Sam Land Bluesland, and then came Horn from the Heart. It's just the unbelievable depth of feeling between these guys, okay? I mean, it's spread off into their legions of fans. Let's face it, they feel it, and they come and talk to us, you know, as though some of these people are still alive. They feel that. But it's, you know, to feel the first generation guys are almost all gone now. But yeah. even to feel the vibe between, you know, the guys that are still in this film, they know they were someplace. They were at something that only happened once in this world so far, okay? And at the time, it just seemed like business as usual, and they were trying to make a living. But it has turned into this vibe that has transformed popular music. And to have been, you know, a small part of documenting that, I feel really lucky.
The film is called Born in Chicago. The website, borninchicagothefilm.com. Look for this film on streaming platforms later this summer. We're thinking around August 1st. John Anderson is the co-director of Born in Chicago. Hey, John, thanks for talking to us today and for all of your really hard work on this project and the other projects you've done, which are just amazing as well. And this is so cool, this story. It's an important story that we should know. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate your interest.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 868 is in the books. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I appreciate you. I appreciate Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer in the WGN radio studio today. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time, right here on Outside the Loop.